Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Thomas Pogge, professor of philosophy at Columbia University, and we're discussing his book, World Hunger and Human Rights. Thomas, glad to have you on the show.
Hi.
Let's begin. Your book is entitled World Poverty and Human Rights. Maybe give the listener a sense of the nature of world poverty, since that clearly is going to set the stage for the rest of the discussion.
Best way to start maybe is with some of the relevant figures. And the best figures that we have are actually collected by the World Bank. The World Bank has two different poverty lines, a $1 a day poverty line and a $2 a day poverty line. And when people hear these figures, they're very widely reported in the press. When people hear these figures, they always think, well, a dollar goes a lot further in the developing countries than it goes hereabouts. And so it sounds awful to live off a dollar a day, but it's really not as bad as it sounds because the buying power of the currency is so much greater. But that's actually not an accurate assessment because the World Bank measures poverty in terms of purchasing power. So a dollar a day really is the purchasing power of a dollar a day. And given that currency does have more purchasing power in the developing countries, what a dollar a day actually amounts to is something in the order of $10 a month in real money, or with a $2 a day poverty line, $20 a month in real money. Real money, I mean exchange rate money. Now, the number of people who live below the lower poverty line of the World Bank is 1.2 billion persons, or roughly one-fifth of the world's population. The number of people who live below the World Bank's higher poverty line, the $2 a day poverty line, $20 a month, is 2.8 billion people, and that is about 47% of the world's population. So very, very large numbers of people are extremely poor by anyone's standards, and the number of people who die of poverty-related causes each year is roughly 18 million, or one-third of all human deaths. So these statistics are really quite shocking. So the poverty problem is quite an enormous problem.
I take it, too, that one of the things that you discuss in your book is not just this absolute nature of poverty, but also its comparison to those of us who are much better off. And I think those figures are important to discuss as well.
Yes, they're quite important. And, of course, the inequality that exists between the poor people whose fate I've just outlined and us, that inequality is one that is very great and also steadily rising. Right. So if you think on the one hand that people, the total population, these 47% of the world's population that live below $2 a day, their share of the global product is around 1.25%. So they have 1.25% of global income, whereas all the people of the high-income countries constitute about 15.6% of the world's population, and between them have 81% of the world's income. So the inequality between rich and poor is steadily growing, is actually now grown to be quite large.
And I understand this reaction. A lot of people, they're going to hear those figures, particularly the $2 a day figure. You're talking about half the people in the world are below the poverty line. A lot of people hear those figures and say, the problem is just too immense. There's nothing we can do about it whatsoever. And it might even be that trying to aid them would be counterproductive. What do you say to those people? Can we do something about this immense poverty problem?
Well, there are two different issues. One is the issue of can we do it in terms of the sheer magnitude? Isn't this just much too big a problem for us to do anything about? The second is the counterproductivity problem. Let me address those in turn. With regard to the first problem, I think the numbers that I've just given about the enormous extent of global inequality as it exists now already go some way towards answering that question, because even though we have 2.8 billion people living in poverty, many, many more than all the people in the rich countries, nevertheless, these people together have only 1.25% of global income. We have 81%. And so you can already see right there that a relatively small proportion of our share of the global product would suffice to dramatically increase their share. So in terms of the order of magnitude, it is quite possible. There are very, very many poor people, but they are so poor and the inequality is so great that a small share of our incomes would suffice to bring them up to the poverty line and even well above the poverty line. Now, the counterproductivity argument is also an argument that's very often made, and there people generally have in mind the idea that the key problem, the key causes of the persistence of poverty in this otherwise quite rapidly developing world is the oppressive and corrupt regimes that prevail in so many of the developing countries. And so it's counterproductive. We can give money there. We can be more liberal in order in allowing them to import goods to our countries and so forth. But in the end, all the good that we might do for the poor countries will only end up in the pockets of their oppressive and corrupt elites, and very little of it will trigger down to the poor people in those countries. Now, that, I think, really is a very significant problem, a problem that affects, for example, the possibility of giving aid to poor countries. But here one must think more deeply and more structurally about why it is that so many of the developing countries are governed by corrupt and oppressive elites. And just to mention a few factors that I think are very relevant, I think these are global factors. This is not cultural phenomena that people in those countries particularly like to be governed by oppressive regimes and corrupt rulers. But the fact that these kinds of rulers can maintain themselves in power in the developing countries, that fact itself, I think, is strongly sustained by global economic and political factors. Let me just say a few of the factors that I think are relevant. One is that under the rules of the existing global order, we recognize any person or group that manages to hold effective power in a developing country as entitled to sell resources in the name of the whole country and as entitled also to borrow money in the name of the country. Now, this sort of recognition that we confer upon these rulers on the basis simply of the fact that they are effectively in power, irrespective of whether they've been elected or whether they're even moderately representative of the interests of their people, these kinds of this privilege that we confer upon them provides a very considerable incentive for people to grab power by force and also enables people who have successfully put themselves in power to maintain themselves in power by getting money through resource sales and borrowing, with which they can then buy the arms and the support of the military that they need to stay in power. So I think while it is superficially true that there's a lot of corruption and oppression in the developing countries and that aid is often channeled into the wrong pockets, it's also true that that problem itself is one in which we have a considerable role.
Okay, certainly both of those are issues we're going to come back and talk about a little bit later. Let's move, though, from the question about what we could do to the question about what we should do, because there are going to be other people who would say, yeah, maybe we could do something about this immense problem. Perhaps there are ways in which we could contribute, we could change our institutions to help those who are impoverished. But morally, though it would be nice of us to do it, we really don't have to do it. Perhaps you could say a little bit about what that position is, and then we can begin to talk about what your criticisms of that position are.
Yeah, that, of course, is by far the dominant picture that we have of the situation with regard to global poverty. The picture that we have is that there are people who are somehow, through factors with which we have nothing to do, got themselves into a very difficult and horrible position. We could help these people, but there are very many of them, and it would be good to help, but we certainly are entitled to decide how much help we want to extend and so forth. Now, my position is a position that disagrees with this idea of helping. I disagree in particular with the explanation of poverty that is presupposed in the helping picture. The explanation, namely, that these people are poor under their own steam, that we have nothing to do with their poverty. I think one very important contributing factor to the persistence of poverty in the modern world is the global institutional order, some of the factors in that order I've already mentioned. And in addition, one could say the particular economic ground rules that have recently, in the 1990s, been negotiated among governments in the so-called Uruguay round leading up to the WTO agreements. These rules are also in many ways quite obviously unfair, by allowing the rich countries to grandfather various protections of their markets into the rules, you know, through anti-dumping duties, tariffs, and so forth. And so, again, the problem, as I see it, is first and foremost that we do not have a global institutional order under which the poor countries could, in fact, thrive and could overcome their own poverty problems effectively. So the first and foremost thing that we should do is not so much think about what we can do to help, but think about what we can do to ease the constraints that now hamper the progress of many of the developing countries.
Okay, the examples you just gave are examples of things that we are arguably doing now that might sustain poverty. And perhaps that's sufficient for the position you want to defend. But do you want to say more than that, that we're also somehow responsible for having created the problem in the first place? And now all we're doing is sustaining a problem which we were largely responsible for creating.
Yeah, I think the claim that we are creating the problem is a difficult claim to sustain because, of course, if you look back at Africa, for example, over the last 500 or 1,000 years, you'll find that people in Africa were poor even 500 or 1,000 years ago. It's not that they had very good and rich lives and have then, through colonialism and slavery and genocide in some of the continents, have somehow become poor. So, but what I do want to say is that the persistence of poverty, the fact that poverty goes on and that even though there is considerable economic growth for the world at large, almost all of that growth goes to the rich and almost none of it goes to the poor. These facts are facts that are explained by the skewed global economic order as it is. So in that way, we do play a role, not so much in getting the poverty problem going in the first place, but in perpetuating it now over the last, 40 years, let's say, post-colonial period.
So the emphasis isn't on the historical claims, though you might want to make that those claims in some cases. The emphasis is on what we're doing now to continue keeping the people from being able to lift themselves out of poverty.
Yes.
Okay. How exactly... I mean, let's take one step back. I want to move on in a moment and talk a little bit more about the ways in which we are sustaining the problem. But let's take a step back on and look at the moral question again. You said that most people begin by assuming that they're impoverished, they're in need, can we help them, but that we're not responsible for, in any way, for their plight. How does the fact that we're responsible for their plight, at least in part, change the moral equation in your view?
Well, it, according to most people's moral conceptions, it makes a very big difference to the stringency of the duties that we have to do something about it. There are some people in philosophy, as you well know, so-called utilitarians, who believe that it doesn't make a difference. So if we can do something to change a situation for the better or for the worse, then the moral obligation that we have to change it for the better is as strong as the difference that we are making to the people whom we are affecting. So in other words, killing somebody or saving somebody from death, those are equally stringent duties according to that utilitarian view. But most of us believe that there's a very great difference, that it is much, much worse to kill somebody than to fail to help somebody who would otherwise who would die if we don't help that person. So I think for most of us believe that there is this difference in stringency. And so I think that appealing to ordinary people, ordinary voters in the United States, for example, it is very, very important to make the argument, to explain to them that it's not just a matter of here are people who are very poor and we could help them, but that in many ways we are actually contributing to their plight and we are also, of course, benefiting from their plight. So think again of this international resource privilege that I mentioned earlier. The fact that anybody who puts himself in power in a developing country can then export the resources in the name of the whole country, of the people, and then use the money to maintain him or herself in power, that fact is a fact that creates a lot of damage in the developing world. But it's also a fact that benefits us because we do not have to worry about whom we buy the resources from. Anybody will do. Any dictator, any junta is just fine. We can obtain legally valid property rights from whoever holds effective power. So in that sense, we are both contributing to the harms and also benefiting from these harms. And again, that creates a more stringent obligation, because you might say money that is legitimately ours in a morally untainted way, we have somewhat less reason to use that for good purposes than money that we have only thanks to an injustice in which we ourselves participate.
Okay. Well, I want to expand on those themes in the second half of the show. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Thomas Pogge, professor of philosophy at Columbia University, and we're discussing his book, World Poverty and Human Rights. On your account, then, it's key to understand that there are ways in which we sustain and perpetuate the plight of the poor. One of the things that you talk about in your book, and you've certainly hit on these issues to some degree earlier, is the idea of us living within a global economic order, the fact that we are all part of a political and economic order is crucial for your account. What exactly do you mean when you say that we are all part of the same global economic order?
Well, what I mean by that is, first and foremost, that there are shared rules or institutions that govern economic interactions across national borders. And secondly, that these rules and institutions have a very major influence on the distribution of income and wealth worldwide. So these rules are not very small, marginal rules that govern, for example, how mail is exchanged across national borders or something like that. But these rules have very serious effects on flows of goods and services across national borders, investment, and so forth. So small, relatively small changes in those rules could have tremendous effects on the livelihoods of people in many different countries.
Okay, and it's the presence of these rules that is somehow crucial for your understanding that we perpetuate poverty.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I take it too that we can go back. You said that we may or may not have been the cause of their plight, but by insisting upon and perpetuating these rules, we continue their plight, we sustain their plight, or perhaps even make it worse than it would have been before. Some of the idea that seems to be going on here is the idea that we have unequal bargaining positions, that because of where we were when we began to develop this global economic order in a more robust sense, that we were able to take advantage of already being better off and to impose these rules upon those who were worse off. Could you elaborate on that theme a bit?
Yes, sure. I would say that there are two different issues that I would like to keep separate, but I agree with both of them. The first point is that these rules are intrinsically unfair. So you can, without knowing anything about the bargaining power of the various parties that negotiated these rules, for example, in the negotiations of the WTO agreements, without looking at that history and the unequal bargaining power, you can conclude that these rules are unfair. For example, you can just see that there are various grandfathering clauses that allow the rich countries to close their markets, shut out something in the order of $700 billion of imports from the developing countries each year, and that there are no corresponding protections that the developing countries are allowed to use against imports from the developed countries. So it is intrinsic unfairness, but when you ask yourself, why was it possible for such unfair agreements to actually be negotiated, then of course the answer is the one that you give, namely that these parties that were negotiating the rules were quite unequal in their bargaining power. It was vastly more important for little developing countries to have access, whatever little access, to the developed Western markets than it was for us to get access to the markets in these developing countries, especially since the most important things that we need for many of the developing countries, namely their raw materials, is something that we will get in any case, with or without special negotiated agreements about market access, simply because anybody holding power in any of these countries has a very strong incentive to sell us these resources.
Could you give some specific examples? You talked about the WTO agreements. What are some of these specific agreements that benefit the developing countries and damage the position of the least developed countries?
Well, there are several things to be mentioned. One is that what we are basically, I mean, the ideology of the WTO agreements has to do with establishing free markets. So we want free markets for capital so that everybody can invest anywhere they like across national borders. We also want free trade so that our goods can flow freely into other countries and their goods into ours. And, however, we do not have free markets in labor, so we do not have the possibility for people from poor countries to offer their labor to us in the richer countries. And that, of course, remains a very important factor sustaining the great inequality in living standards between rich and poor countries. So there's only a partial freeing of markets. But even if you look just aspect by aspect, for example, at the free trade in goods, you will find that there are very significant constraints on the importation of goods and very significant constraints on free markets. One example is the enormous farm subsidies that both the Americans and the Europeans are giving to their farmers to the tune of several hundred billion dollars a year. And these subsidies allow relatively inefficient farm industries to persist in the rich countries, thereby displacing the imports that otherwise would come from developing countries. So farmers in the developing countries cannot compete with farmers in the developed countries for market share in the developed countries because of these barriers to free trade, these subsidies. In addition to that, there are tariffs and anti-dumping duties. Recently in the United States, for example, there were significant tariffs imposed on imported steel, which hurt in particular the Chinese, the Russians, and the Brazilians, who have large steel industries. And once again, this is something that interferes with the operation of free markets. So I think that if we had genuinely free markets, as the WTO was supposed to have delivered, if we really had these genuinely free markets, the developing countries would do a great deal better than they are actually doing. It is really they who would need more protection than they receive under the WTO rules, and we certainly should not have these very heavy protections at their expense.
So one way of putting the problem is that we claim to be concerned in a completely free, open, capitalistic free market economy, but that's not in fact what we have, that we go out of our way to make sure that it's a biased free market economy, one that favors us to the extent of those who are less well off.
Right.
And I take it too then that you would say that if it were genuinely a free market economy, free markets in capital, free markets in labor, free markets in goods, completely open exchanges, that alone would go some distance toward aiding the impoverished people of the world.
Oh, it would go quite a distance in that direction, yes. I mean, that is what makes it somewhat comical to see all this discussion about globalization these days, right? That the way the discussion is often presented in the newspapers and the media is that you have, on the one hand, the free marketeers who have won the battle and have successfully globalized, and on the other hand, you have these globalization opponents who want to go back to a state where there's very little interaction between different countries. And I think this is wrong on both counts. It's wrong, first and foremost, because the globalization that we now have isn't really a free market globalization. It falls short in many important respects that I have just outlined. And secondly, many of the anti-globalization people are not really against globalization as such, but rather they are against this particular path of globalization that has brought so many benefits to the rich countries and has done so little for the global poor.
That certainly leads us in the direction of this, of the last part of the show, the last 5 minutes of the show, which is what can we do if someone hearing this interview says, you know, you're right, we not only do not help them, we've actually put them in the position or sustained their position where they are impoverished. We think we need to do something about it. What can we do? One of the answers you just gave is we can actually push for a genuinely global economic order, but what else could we do?
Well, I think the most important thing that we can do as citizens of the rich countries, and in particular as citizens of the United States, which is the most powerful, politically, economically most powerful country on earth, the most important thing we can do is try to influence U.S. foreign policy, both in terms of its economic policies, import-export, and so forth, and also, and maybe even more importantly, in terms of what the United States is doing within international organizations such as the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, in terms of setting the rules. So if in the moment the situation is that I think the vast majority of American citizens know relatively little about what goes on in the developing world, they don't know exactly how much poverty there is, and they also don't know very much about the causes of poverty, certainly the international causes of poverty. And as we learn more about that, I think we can exert some pressure on the U.S. foreign policy in order to make the contribution that the Americans make to the setting of international rules one that takes account not only of our collective national interest, but also of the fairness of the overall rules. Right, it's a well-understood principle, a principle that we see, for example, in the organization of a political system, fair competition between parties, and also in the organization of a legal order, a fair representation both for the defendant and for the prosecution, or in a civil trial between the different parties. It's a well-understood principle that we want, on the one hand, partiality, and we find it a good system, that which involves competition and interested parties fighting it out. But on the other hand, we also agree that such competition will work well only if the rules are reasonably fair so that all parties have a fair chance to participate. And I think that second point is one that has gotten lost on the international level. On the international level, inequality has reached such heights that essentially the rich and the powerful countries can set the rules by themselves without worrying about keeping these rules reasonably fair. And that is a responsibility that at this point the powerful countries have and that we should do more to remind our governments to live up to.
Okay, so when most people think about trying to help relieve world poverty, they think of giving contributions. And, you know, perhaps you think that's not a bad idea, but that's not the main thing that we ought to be doing. The main thing we ought to be doing is to try to change our own institutions, which help perpetuate poverty.
Yes, that would be the most important thing, which would actually eradicate the problem rather than merely mitigate it. One drawback about giving money to Oxfam or organizations like that, one drawback of that is that we will just have to keep doing it for the foreseeable future so long as a skewed international economic order will reproduce the problem of poverty. It's very difficult to see how there could be enough structural change, even with the very good work that these organizations do, how there could be enough structural change to actually eradicate the problem of poverty. Still, you know, it is obviously a very good thing to support these organizations. And there I would say that we should do it not with the thought that we are hereby helping unfortunate people, but we should do it with the thought that we are thereby compensate for some of the damage that we are doing through our government to their interests, and also that we are thereby repaying some of the benefits that we reap from a global economic order that is quite unjustly skewed in our favor.
So politically, what would you do? Are you talking about working for candidates? Are you encouraging people to try to educate others about the actual nature of the global economic order, or perhaps all of these?
Well, not all of it in the sense that each of us should do all of these things. I think we are all very different people. We have different strengths and different weaknesses, which we alone are best able to judge, and I think each of us can make, can sort of know and understand where they can make the best contribution. Right? I, for example, myself, I would not do very well, I think, in the political arena as a politician or something of that sort, so I write philosophy books in the hopes that people will read them and that they will go out and do the kinds of things that I myself would not be very well able to do. So we need people of all different kinds. We need activists in both national parties, in international organizations, people who will educate people about the problem of poverty. And it's through the cooperation of many people doing different things that I think the problem in the end will be solved.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking today to Thomas Pogge, professor of philosophy at Columbia University. We've been discussing his book, World Poverty and Human Rights. This is Hugh LaFollette, Friday's Issues. Good day.